But the one meat I thought was most interesting, which we used, it was called a galliac. And this animal was the result of a cross between, is a Galloway cow and a yak. And of course they were experimenting to see whether or not these animals would be good to breed and raise in interior Alaska, another part of the biological survey work. And about the time I arrived, apparently the experiment was figured kind of a failure, so I had the choice of butchering these animals. And they were good eating, I will say that. No, just about as good as the beef. I wouldn't say it was number one grade or prime, but it was edible. You know, in 1933, when I first enrolled here, the enrollment was about 120, and there were about 18 faculty members. And of course, being such a small school and a relatively isolated school, why the faculty and students were really very close. The of course, when I came, I wanted to be a civil engineer, and so I enrolled in civil engineering, but many of my friends thought I was crazy because, after all, mining was a thing in those days. Everyone was a mining engineer, and they didn't know, of course, that I had a wish to become a railroad engineer. But then another very popular course was home economics. And believe it or not, it was not popular only on the part of the girls. There were a lot of the men enrolled in home economics, because many of them, of course, were prospecting in the summertime or working in remote areas. And techniques that they could learn at home ec, such as baking bread and that sort of thing, was worthwhile. So they, home economics was a popular curriculum. Of course, agriculture was another one, since it was an agriculture college and school of mines. And a business, and of course another course which was called general science, was quite popular. And I have to tell you something about transportation. Again, I read the papers and I hear people talking about, oh, these terrible roads. Well, that hits me many ways. But I often wish that those people who are complaining about a chuck hole or a bump could have been here in 1933. Those faculty members who lived in town and those students who lived in town, you see, I think it was in 32 that the Brill car quit running. What, do you know, Howard? Because when I came, the Brill car wasn't running. And Paul Grimen and the Standard Garage ran the bus that operated between Fairbanks and the college. And Paul was an energetic young man who had visions of building up a real business, but the Alaska Road Commission didn't cooperate a great deal with him. And the road, actually, which is now the College Road, was nothing more than a trail. There was no surfacing on it of any kind. And in the spring, faculty members and students just planned on walking to school, because you couldn't get through the road. The road was a quagmire, and it usually was that way for a couple of weeks during the spring breakup. And another thing that I remember about Paul Grimen is, in his bus is that he started out with a relatively, maybe the size of a school bus, a small school bus. And of course, his patronage was such that he had to increase the size of his bus. So during the summer, he cut the thing in half and lengthened it 10 feet. And I don't know where he got the additional seats, but he lengthened it, rebuilt it, and proceeded to accommodate the increased patronage. And another thing, in the wintertime, you see, the Alaska Road Commission in those days, they didn't work. I mean, they didn't maintain any roads. And so the road out here was not maintained. Well, of course, the Paul Grimen, in order to keep his business going, he fashioned a plow and stuck it on the front of his bus. And so when you went out in the morning, you plowed the road. When you came back, you plowed it on the other side. And that way he kept the road open and maintained his business. I know I'm rambling on. I want to mention, though, something about Bunnell, who, in my opinion, was a real great man. Bunnell had an awful battle to fight in getting the school, getting it going, and keeping it going. And of course, he would attend every legislative session that took place, trying to influence particularly legislators from Central Alaska and Southeastern Alaska to give some money to this school way up here in the interior, which according to them wasn't benefiting them a damn. And so he spent a great deal of time in Juneau during legislative sessions, as well as back in Washington trying to get federal help. Well, during these trips out and back, of course, he traveled by railroad and by steamboat. And so, I don't know if any of you remember the Alaska steamship boats, but they stopped in every port. And while they were in port, Bunnell was at the schools. He was talking to the students, explaining to them the benefits of the university, and trying to recruit some freshmen for the succeeding year. He also set up a program whereby they gave exams. They may still be doing it, I don't know, throughout the state, yearly, in all the high schools, and those students, or the student who got the highest grade in those exams, got free room at the university for a year. So it was quite a thing to try for those exams. I tried, but I was way down the list. But Bunnell had a tremendous concern for the students. And as Howard said, he had some very stiff regulations. One thing, there was no smoking, and I mean no smoking, because all the buildings were frame, wood, and dry, and the floors were full of oil, and if a fire had started, there was no way you could possibly stop it. And another thing, though, that many of us talked about was Bunnell and his closing of windows. In the wintertime, your windows in all the dormitories, all the buildings, had to be closed because you couldn't heat Alaska. And he would make rounds. And boy, if your building had any windows open, you knew about it. Another thing, lights had to be out. After all, he was generating his own power here in the power plant, and he didn't have too big a generator. And so if you didn't need the lights were to be out. You could look at the university from Fairbanks in those days, and you didn't see any street lights. You saw very few building lights. And I'd just like to say, give you one more experience. Located where he was in his home, he saw everything. and I can attest to that. I had been to town one evening, rather late, and this was after Prohibition had just been repealed. And so, of course, I had to have a bottle of wine. And so I got myself a bottle of wine and came home on the bus about midnight. And I met a young lady on the bus and who also liked the wine that I had. And we ended up taking a walk from here down to the experiment station and, you know, sipping on the wine and talking about the wonders of nature. And of course, didn't get to bed till about 2 or 3 in the morning. Of course, next day was a work day, and I was at that time working with a carpenter, and we were excavating in the main floor of the main building an area large enough to put in about a 2,000-gallon tank. And so we had a hole that was about 10 feet in diameter and about 15 feet deep, and I was at the bottom of that hole, picking and shoveling and not feeling very good. And the boss, the fellow I was working with, he was gone, and I was alone down there. All of a sudden, you know, I heard a voice say, "Good morning, Woodrow." I looks up, and here's Bunnell. "How are you feeling this morning?" "Oh, I'm feeling fine." "Well, did you have a good time last night?" As I say, there wasn't much that he missed. Another occasion I wanted to go down to Anchorage to the fur rendezvous. They had just started, and I was still here in school. And I was working here, of course, and so I had to get his permission to leave. I went down to his house, and this was in the evening, and asked him if I could go. And after some discussion, he gave me permission. And I turned to leave, and he said, "Woodrow," he says, "I'd like to ask you a question." He says, "I've got a problem," he says, "I need some advice on." And I couldn't imagine what advice he was going to give. But he says, "Now, Woodrow," he says, "I want you to put yourself in my place." He says, "I'm the president of a university, of a college." He says, "I have a large number of young people here whose parents have placed those children in my care." And he said, "So I get concerned." Now, he said, "The other day," he said, "the bus came, and the driver left some packages in the garage," which they always did. You could call up any store in town and ask for an order, French fries or hamburgers or whatever you needed, anything from a drugstore. And we put on the bus and brought out here, and we left in the garage. And he tells me that he went in the garage, and here were all these packages. And in one of the packages was a bottle of liquor. And it was addressed to one of the girls in the girls' dorm, a young girl. And he says, "Now, what would you do in a case like that if you were in my shoes?" I didn't know. And so I says, "Well, what did you do, Dr. Bunnell?" "Well," he says, "you know," he says, "I was concerned for the other students and the other girls in that dormitory. So," he says, "I thought it best to take that bottle of liquor over to the girls' dormitory and give it to the girl to whom it was addressed." And he did that. And he didn't want the liquor to be obtained by anyone else. And is incidentally, the girl was turned out to be one of his favorites.
Right.
He always just thought the world of her. But that was Bunnell. And as far as from my viewpoint, spending the time I did here under him, the university was Bunnell. And without him, and without the dedication that he had, there were times when the university would have shut down. I know personally that he used his own money to pay the faculty salaries because he had no other money and he couldn't borrow anymore.
Right.
And I know that he borrowed all he could from, we'll say, Nerland and Hess, who were fairly well off. I don't know if he ever got any from Stroker or not in the bank. He got them from other people. But the spirit of the university is, I think, was really unique, because it was small, because everyone that was here because they wanted to be. They were working, most of them were working their way through college. There were very few that had finances coming to them from parents or any other location. Many of them, of course, as I did in the summertime, would work in the mines and come here and work in the fall and the winter. In the wintertime, we'd work as janitors or whatever necessary. And so I brought with me, incidentally, Bunnell was a poet also, and many other, among other things. And he loved to write. I'd like to read you something that Cashin put in his book, which I think is illustrates Bunnell better than anything I've seen. It says, "The drama in which we are privileged to play a part is to be enacted upon a stage coextensive with Alaska, and the scene is here. The players best fitted for the work at hand are those who believe in themselves, who have the outstanding virtues of loyalty and courage, and who come upon the stage just as it is here. Here is where we are, and here is where the work we have to do must be done." That's Bunnell. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer some, but I've taken more than my time. But you see, an ex-prof definitely knows when to shut up. Thank you very much.
More buildings in. The powerhouse now has two stacks on it. Did when I was a student here. Excuse me, Paul. In fact, I can recall as a student, we went over and stole a bell off the roof of the old powerhouse, and which had been up there for, I don't know, about 10 or 15 years. Nobody knew what to do with it. So one night we went over and stole it from the roof of the powerhouse and set it up in old main dorm, and I had the job of painting it and putting some lettering on it. And then the administration and everybody else found reasons and uses for that bell. Well, ultimately the bell became the sport of the day to steal a bell from one dorm to another. See one head shaking there. And ultimately it became the trophy for the bell tournament. I don't know whatever happened to that bell, but now they have a little dinky ship's bell down in Patty Building that is now the bell tournament trophy. We stole it off the roof there, and it made the rounds between the dorms there for a while. And we have Don Cook representing the 40s here. Don, I don't know if you ever met my brother. I don't know, he may have come after you. Jake?
Well, he couldn't have.
My brother was known as Big Jake. He used to be the hockey player on the hockey team, and they didn't have to worry about the other team making any goals because by the time he got the padding on, there wasn't any goal to get the puck through. I'd like to have Don Cook up here representing the 40s. I've known him for the past several years, and he's been traveling back and forth from time to time over to Taiwan. He told me one time that every time he went over there, he got sick for, 10 days or 2 weeks because he couldn't stand the water over there. Don?
I called up Bill Jacobson and asked him where this event was to take place. The reply I got was, ha, 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 the archives, of course. So I guess that might apply to some of us, but maybe not to others. For the benefit of that little machine there, and so that I don't get to be rambling too much, and with your indulgence, I'd sort of like to read what I have to say so that I can keep myself on the right track. I think as we progress, however, we'll find that there are varying first impressions of the University of Alaska. But I think the final impressions you'll find that are going to be somewhat the same, and we'll probably have the same type of a trend. If we compare the growth of the University of Alaska with that of a typical child, we find that there are periods which bring out the worst or the best in a development pattern. As an example, most children go through what are called the terrible twos. And those of you that are parents, I assure you understand this, that they're into everything and everywhere at the age of two. To draw an analogy to this, I would say that I was here at the University of Alaska during the fitful 40s. Fitful in the sense of being unsettled and uncertain. It was unsettled in that those were the war years. And there was confusion in the minds of the students, the faculty, and the staff as to what the future would be. Uncertainty also existed as the actual continuance of the University of Alaska was uncertain many times during that period. To draw you a picture of what went on then and what goes on now, I would like to go back to my first acquaintance with the University of Alaska. I first heard of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines back in 1937. Strangely enough, it was in California, a little Associated Oils town site called Avon in California. Somehow I ran across a catalog of the University of Alaska. I don't know how it got there or who had it. At least my memory doesn't serve me in that purpose. But I know one thing, it was a far cry from the present advertising campaigns that the universities have, where you have colorful brochures, you have radio programs, and you have television. I think at the present time, I don't know whether Dr. Romy come from, are you a resident of Alaska?
Born in Surrey.
You're born in Surrey. Well, I'm the first speaker then who was not born in Alaska. I was born in Oregon. As this catalog I was talking about was several years old, I wrote a letter to the University of Alaska to see primarily whether it still existed. I was presently surprised to receive a letter from the president with a simple application form requesting a high school transcript. This type of personal touch, I'm sure, no longer exists. And I'm sure that the application forms have long since lost their simplicity. Today, it is a short 3-hour flight from Seattle to Fairbanks. But in 1939, logistics were a little more complicated. After much correspondence, I find that the Alaska steamship vessel Columbia connected with Alaska Railroad at a place called Seward, where the student special would carry me to College Station for the fall semester. In other words, there was a special train that was run every year from Seward to Fairbanks in time to register for the fall semester. After 7 days on the Columbia, which included 3 days on the stormy Gulf of Alaska, my exuberance for the University of Alaska had diminished somewhat upon arriving at Seward. Now, it wasn't only me. I think at that time there must have been upwards of 10 or 15 other students that were on the same boat. Students that were coming from New York, from Indiana, from Oregon, and other places in the lower 48. And I think their exuberance after that trip across the Gulf was also pretty bad. And it was an unusual trip in that it was very stormy. And I think everybody on the boat was sick, including the captain and including the cook. A little story on that. I went to bed early on the first day across the Gulf, and I stayed for 3 days. And there was a fellow from New York who was quite frisky, and figured he was quite a sailor. So he would come in and razz us a little bit. There was, these rooms had four bunks in them. There was three of us in the bunk, not feeling too good. So he said, well, he says, I hope you fellas are having a good time. I'm going to breakfast. Well, he went down to the breakfast, all right. And you know, if you look in the galley on these ships, the doors will, when the rough weather, will swing back and forth. And he started to eat breakfast. And he didn't get very far. In about 5 minutes, he came roaring back, and the fourth bunk was occupied for the rest of the trip. My spirits, however, picked up to some degree in Seward with the excitement of a train full of students being picked up at points such as Seward, Anchorage, Palmer, Wasilla, Talkeetna, and even stops along the Alaska Railroad where there was no sign of any visible station. In other words, somebody comes out on the railroad tracks and once arrived, they flag the train down, the train would stop and pick them up. Looking back is the only time that I can remember when Anchorage was smaller than Fairbanks. Anchorage had a population of about 1,800 at that time, and Fairbanks was in excess of 2,000. Now we hear the stories that Fairbanks is so much smaller than Anchorage. I'm afraid that, in contrast to Woody Johansson's talk, my first impression of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines was not very favorable. We arrived in a typical cold September rain. That same university truck that hauled Woody's baggage up also hauled everybody else's baggage up in 1939. It was available to haul our luggage up the hill, but the students had to walk up the muddy, slippery road to get onto the main campus. And I think the mud at that time had been raining quite a lot, was almost ankle deep. If a jet flight had been available, I would have been on it. But my stomach rebelled at the thought of another session with the Gulf of Alaska. I was committed, and for that I will always be grateful. The physical facilities at that time consisted of a rambling three-story wood structure that served the dual purpose of classrooms and administration building. Three wood-frame men's dormitories named the main dorm, the club dorm, and unit 5. The club dorm, incidentally, at that time on the bottom or ground floor also housed the dining facilities. A concrete structure, which still exists over here, housed the library and the gymnasium downstairs. Now, if you were up in the library studying at any time, and Woody Johansson happened to be down playing basketball, you could hear the thump thump of the ball on the ceiling of the gym, which was the floor of the library. There were other concrete buildings also in existence. We had the small power plant, which is a concrete building, a smaller version of the Eielson building, which at one end of it, as Bill Jacobson said, also contained Unit 5, which was a wood structure. Harriet Hess Hall was the other concrete structure. Today, men could cry discrimination in regards to dormitory facilities because the men lived in the old wooden dorms and the women had the nice new concrete structure. The classroom and laboratory facilities were austere and efficient according to today's standards, but were more than compensated, at least in my opinion, by the friendly family-type atmosphere and the caliber and dedication of the faculty and staff. The student body at that time was slightly in excess of 300, in which the majority of it were male. The males, or the students in general, I think had an average age somewhat greater than at present time. I don't remember what the figures are, but I would say that was somewhere in the mid-20s. There was no state educational loan programs or abundance of scholarship programs. If you experienced financial difficulties, several options were available. Quit school for a while and find a job, which many of them did. Find a part-time job in town or at the university, which, of course, many of them did, including myself. One other possibility also existed: to approach President Bunnell for a personal loan. The latter course of action was taken by many students, including myself. However, summer employment was available in the gold mines and elsewhere around the vicinity, and the capability did exist to make enough money in the summer to finance another school year. The faculty also and the administration was very cooperative in that extent, in that you could leave school 2 or 3 weeks before school let out, and you could come back to school 2 or 3 weeks after it officially started and make up your deficiencies likewise, if you think you hadn't made enough money.
I had come from the East Coast of the United States, from Connecticut and Pennsylvania. And in the discussion about the Alaska statehood, I read many articles in the New York Times about Alaska. And I thought, I was then at a 2-year college and doing fairly well, and had to go on the next year to another college. And I wondered if perhaps it wouldn't be worth coming to Alaska for a year to continue my education. So I went to a neighboring college and found they had a very slim volume, which was a catalog of the University of Alaska. And I sent all my records off into the blue to Alaska, and finally got a letter back from Laura Jones saying, well, thank you very much for your records, why don't you apply? And sent me an application, which I sent off, and eventually came back the letter that I had been accepted. And so I sold my car and bought a new Porsche and drove off across the country, and what was a great experience for me, never having been further west than eastern Pennsylvania. And the further west I got, the more exciting it got, until I reached Dawson Creek in the midst of a torrential downpour. The town was booming, the streets were dirt, and from then on, it was a disaster. The Peace River Bridge had collapsed. It was one-way traffic across it. And I maneuvered this small foreign car up the Alaska Highway without destroying it completely, but arriving in Fairbanks on a nice, warm, sunny day after driving the last 800 miles in what appeared to me a sea of dust. It was at least 6 inches deep. The inside of the car was completely covered with dust, and I could not run my fingers through the hair that I then had. And drove out to the west part of the Fairbanks to discover this small college, and I was delighted. I was quite pleased, and I signed up to become a member of the University of Alaska Fire Department, which gave me free room in Hess Hall on the first floor. That fire department experience was very important to me because it probably kept me in Alaska. And one experience I can remember is my roommate at Hess Hall, whose name was Charles Vernon, who was studying English. His name was actually Casimir Stokersky, but he had taken on Charles Vernon after some difficulties in his family. He had become very enamored of a blue-eyed young lady who was living in Wickersham Hall. He was very fond of her. Matter of fact, he was lyric about it and wrote poetry, which was published by me, who was editor of the new Polar Star, in the Polar Star. And it was very bad poetry, and he was quite unsuccessful in pursuing pursuing this young lady. And finally, he was told that she had taken up with another young man, and that he had no chance whatsoever. Well, I returned to my room in Hess Hall to find a little note on my bed that said, I have gone to Tommy's elbow room, and I am drunk. please come get me. So I drove into town and found Charles, and indeed he was, very, and I coaxed him into my car, and we headed back towards the university. And the temperature was close to 45 or 50 below. My car had been started by a number of people who helped push it through this parking lot, which was in front of Constitution Hall. And for all I know, Klaus helped push it. At any rate, we drove out along College Road in this very crispy weather. And Chuck was talking about himself and his attributes as a man about town, a literate person, a poet, well-read, and he had many skills, one of which was fighting fires, and there was a fire, and why didn't we fight it? I looked at him, and I looked over, and by golly, there was a house on fire. So we drove up. And Chuck leaped out of the car and he said, "Have you called the university fire department?" And they said, "Oh, no, we haven't done that. We called the person who lived at Fort Caribou, which is just the foundation has just been demolished. It used to be the small two-story log house that was right near where the Whole Earth Exchange is." It was only several blocks away, but they had not yet arrived. And so someone went in and called the university fire department. And we could hear the siren on the hill as we went up and started shoveling snow into the windows of this building, which was of some help. Shortly thereafter, the fellow at Fort Caribou arrived with the fire engine, which was a Jeep, and a trailer, which had a pump on it, and a 200-gallon tank. And we took things in hand at that point. Chuck was quite intoxicated, and so he was very demanding when he was in that sort of condition. And so he directed people to do this and that, and people followed him. He grabbed a hose from the gentleman who had arrived, and he told me to go up the roof and chop a hole in the roof because the fire was burning in the overhead, and that he would come up with a hose and he would put it out. So I put a ladder up against the roof and went up on the roof, and it was quite slippery. It was an aluminum roof. Went up to the ridgepole of the roof with an axe, went down to the area that was burning. The roof was quite warm and the snow was melting on it, and proceeded to chop a hole in the roof. And then I yelled, I said, "Chuck, it's ready." He said, "All right, I'll be right there." So he started up the ladder. And as he reached the top of the ladder, I knew the things were going wrong, because he stepped out sort of very dramatically onto the sloping aluminum roof with this ice melting on it, did a 90-degree flip, fell onto the roof, and rolled out of sight with the hose clutched to his bosom and the water streaming past his face. I yelled for him, "Chuck, Chuck, are you all right?" And finally there was this dull groan from below, and up the ladder he came again. And he started to do the same thing again, and I yelled at him. Well, it was very difficult. He avoided it. He stayed where he was. But it was very difficult to recognize him at this point because he was completely white. And he crinkled when he moved. He was completely covered with ice. I went down the roof and I grabbed the hose from him, and we went back up on the roof and I helped him up onto the ridgepole. So here were two of us sort of straddling the ridgepole, peering down into the upper part of the roof. Fire is burning away here, and we're putting water onto the fire. Suddenly, from behind us came a voice. "How did this fire start?" We both turned around rapidly, and behind us was a gentleman in a tweed jacket with a tie on, a white shirt, with very good shoes. We said, "Where did you come from?" And he said, "I'm from the Polar Star. How did this fire start?" And proceeded to interview us. Well, actually, by this time, the university fire department had arrived in all its strength, and we continued the interview on the roof while the university put out the fire below us. The fire was put out, and the tradition is with firemen that the person who first answers the call stays with the fire to make sure it is out. And so the university left, and Chuck and I went back to Hess Hall, and everybody went to bed. About 2 hours later, the alarm sounded, and George Knight, who was then fire chief, came roaring into Hess Hall and said, "Let's go, men." And we said, "Where is it?" And he said, "You'll see as soon as you go out the door." So we went roaring out the door, and off in the distance was our fire, and it was burning away again. So we raced to the fire engine, one of which was an open cab GMC truck that was a regular flatbed truck that had been converted into a fire engine, and it was just deadly to drive in the wintertime, but it was the only thing we had, that and a very large and not very good Sea Graves fire engine. So we drove down the hill off to our fire, which was now burning merrily. Unfortunately, the owner of the house, who had taken out his furniture when the fire caught on fire, initially, had put all its furniture back in and then gone away, knowing that the fire was out, and the fire reignited, which it hadn't been completely out, and burned up its furniture, and we arrived to find the place almost totally destroyed. But the owner had been in fairly good humor. And he said, "Well, sometimes you win them and sometimes you lose them." I was very impressed by this attitude. And we fought the fire, and we spent some time at it, and we dumped many thousands of gallons of on it. We took trips back and forth to the university to get water from the very large water tower. And then finally, seeing that it was almost completely out, or at least out as we could put it, went back to the university, went back to Hess Hall, put away the fire engine, went to bed. About an hour and a half later, there was a tippy-tippy on the door, and I woke up from my bed. Went to the door, and there was George Knight, and he had both hands in his pockets, and he was walking somewhat like this, and he said, "Hi." I said, "What do you mean, hi? And you just woke me up." He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm sleeping. I've got classes tomorrow. I'm tired." He said, "Would you like to go to a fire?" And I said, "Oh, no." And he said, "Yes." And so he said, "Wake up, Chuck." So I woke up Chuck, and the three of us went out to the fire engine, and without sirens, drove down the hill to the house that is again burning merrily away, and stayed there until 10 o'clock in the morning, keeping one end of the building burning in order to keep warm, while we kept the other knocked down so it didn't spread to adjacent buildings. Well, this attitude really impressed me about the university, and I thought perhaps that a kind of place that could spawn these kind of people perhaps was the kind of place I wanted to stay. I took courses from Minnie Wells, too. And Minnie Wells always terrified me when I took classes from her. But it wasn't until I visited her at Manly Hot Springs one summer that I found out what sort of person she could be when she was not in the classroom. She was a wild lady. I also took classes from Moberg, who at one point in a class in Main Building in political science, in his disgust for his students, passed out pieces of candy to everybody and proceeded to berate us for our lack we weren't very good students. The university grew at this period, and part of the call of President Patty was that we needed a new gymnasium. The old gymnasium was not adequate, and I believe it was Dr. Patty who, in his concern about Main Building, had put aluminum foil on all the windows in the second floor of the library, just in case the Main Building caught on fire, it wouldn't catch all the books on fire in the library. Klaus, do you remember then? Was that in? Well, all the windows in the library towards Main Building were covered with aluminum foil. Dean Goldseth, not only was a rather strange person, he raised the ire of many of the students, and in the spring it culminated in a hanging of the dean in effigy, with great turmoil and churning in the streets. The Polar Star that year, this is his first year, 58-59, had five editors. I was editor twice. At one point, we were producing the Polar Star three times a week because of the objections that the Polar Star never had any news. So we decided to put out the paper more often in the hope that it would be at least more topical, even if it really wasn't very good news. And I think that you may not have a complete collection of the Polar Star for that year. there was quite a bit of turmoil. At the end of the year, I was thrown out of my year for lack of scholarship. And the following year, I returned dedicated at this point to getting an education and spending less time dealing with fire departments, newspapers, uprisings, and other such difficulties. And I managed to do that. That period was also one of great building on the campus. The Patty Gym was finally built. Hess Hall was torn down, I believe it was in, at the end of the 60s, or was it 70s? 1968. It was a very difficult job to tear down Hess Hall. It was a very fine building. It was quite strong. The concrete structure was very good. Between the rooms, unfortunately, though, when I was in it, there was only beaver board. And I remember one night, with great shock, discovering a bayonet coming through one of the walls. There were a lot of strange things happened in Hess Hall. I believe Klaus was in Hess Hall. And Klaus was amongst those who took one of the inhabitants and put him on a plane to Fort Yukon one night with a one-way ticket and a hockey stick. He returned the next day with a dog. And I've never quite understood that, but and without the hockey stick. The old powerhouse was torn down, which also is very difficult, and I understand that that building still exists. Part of the foundations were not destroyed and are now part of the foundations of this building. The main building was torn down. Club dorm was torn down. Club dorm, when I first came here, had a cafeteria in the basement that was run by a gentleman called the Count, who had a variety of restaurants around Fairbanks, and who seemed to close them and open them with an annual turnover. His last being the one that later became the Kentucky Fried Chicken place. The 60s was also the time of a great deal of activity in the English department. And the Fairbanks, the University Flying Poets, lived in that time and flew around Alaska reading poetry. It was a time of activity, a great deal of literary activity, and it was a quite exciting period for many people. I was able to take advantage of it, and it has guided me since that time, and I occasionally hear rumors of the people hither and yon, and this last summer encountered the son of one of the gentlemen who was one of the flying poets on the road in Gold Street. It was a period when the Geophysical Institute reached a culmination of its life in the in the Chapman Building, and moved up onto the West Ridge. It was a very exciting period, and my scholarship improved from that first year, and was finally able to graduate in '66. And then I went to work for the university in the same year. That's about all I've got. Anybody have any questions about it? Yeah.
If you had a connection with the English department at that time, give us any light on Mount McKinley University?
No, I can't give you any light on Mount McKinley University. But I can, I can't. Many of you who were not here in those years may not know that the university once ran a trailer car down at the bottom of the hill, where now is a great ash pit, was my residence. I lived in a 28-foot by 8-foot trailer there for a period of time, with a engine in many pieces underneath the kitchen table, writing papers for Minnie Wells, and we were not alone in that endeavor, because there other people's cars would seem to fall apart very rapidly in that trailer court and pieces would be hauled greasy into the trailers where they would be repaired in reasonable weather inside.
That That wasn't a green trailer on the front row, was it, Mayor?
No, it was the second row. Why?
I was in a green trailer in the front row.
Oh. Understand that that trailer court appeared overnight, practically, with wire that had been lifted, power line wire that had been lifted from some project elsewhere on campus. Rumors that Mr. William King had something to do with it.
Probably.
And he went on to work with Golden Valley and other projects after his graduation from the university.
Yeah, he was down there.
Anything else?
One time in the fire department here on campus, they had an old V12 with a pumper, and as long as they kept it on a level road, why, it was all right, but once they got off the level road, it didn't go any place. That isn't awesome. The last picture we have, I don't know why, but it's the only one that's in color. Maybe they finally figured out how to make colored pictures in Alaska. Looks a little more up to date than some of the earlier photos. It's even got Woods Hole here in the middle that some people call the fountain nowadays. It was called Woods Hole at one time after our fourth president, who later became our mayor in the city of Fairbanks. Merrick brought out a lot of fun times of the old fire department. And today, the fire department of the university can rank with any fire department we've got in the whole interior part of the state, to the point that we now have a working agreement with the area around the university campus. It's a working agreement to supply fire protection in the entire area around the university. And we have quite an array of vehicles up there, and would sort of put the old V12 to shame. I don't know if you remember that old rig or not, Mayor. I remember one time out on what is now Miller Hill, that used to be part of Yankovich Road. It always used to have a frost boil at the bottom of the hill every spring, and they had a fire up in Lawler's Field up there. They sent the old V12 up there, and it got stuck in frost boil, and they had to dump all the water in the ditch and get the D6 cat out there to pull it out of the hole in the middle of the road. But as time went on, we got into the 70s, and somebody by the name of Joan came along. Became Joan Oster Camp. I got to know her several years ago when I was working in grants and contracts. Used to have to call her up on the phone, and later as I got into my own office, which is now the proposal office, and had to push paper back and forth between IMS and getting the chancellor to sign it, who was always rather indignant of having to sign 8 or 10 copies of the same thing. Right, Dr. Feller? Don't feel bad. I have the same problem with the present chancellor. He doesn't like to sign more than one copy either. Joan Oster Camp.
I get the impression, Bill, that one of the reasons I was brought in was to represent the 70s and the women's movement at the time also. You made the comment about the only female. I really didn't think of before that point.
It didn't really start out that way.
Not that way. You mentioned the fact about the bell, roving bell that went from place to place. I remember the first year, perhaps the second year after we came out, Chuck, you might remember that. We were living up on Chandelier in the faculty housing, and they didn't disappear with a bell at that case. One of the students' practice for Engineers Day, naturally, was to pick up the Volkswagen, which happened to be our Volkswagen, and deposit it in the hallway of the Bunnell Building. I don't know how they got it in, but there was quite a bit of problem getting it out again. Not that big a door. But that was one of the first years after we were up here, and I came up following with my husband in 68, as a faculty wife at that time, and then several years later started back into a master's degree program. Actually, I should clarify, I didn't start back into the program. I started just taking classes for the fun of it. And after several years, people said that I was around so much, I might as well be doing something worthwhile. So actually, Bill, from the time I officially enrolled in the program, it only took me about 4 years. But 3.5 years or so prior to that, when I actually started. The 70s at the university really recaps, I think, what everybody else has been saying at that time. It was a time of change even within the decade, but it was a fun time to be here. It shows the university as a very growing, viable institution yet at this time. A healthy period during the growing spurt, but definitely with growing pains. The student population, of course, during the time of the 70s, first of all, followed the boom and bust period and very uncertainty of the time during the pipeline. At the time, it leveled off, and by the end of the 70s, it had doubled the number of students. And at that time, of course, something new came about, that we were no longer the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, but the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. And there's, of course, been quite a bit of alternate resentment and sometimes, I think, welcome of the establishment of our sister campuses at Anchorage and Juneau. But relatively new, of course, with the size that they are now, and we're at the end of the 70s. The expansion was very hard on the administration. I think all of us remember the turnover of presidents during the decade of the 70s. You mentioned going to school during five federal administrations. Well, I went to school during five campus administrations in the 70s. But along with all the change and the upheaval, it was a very productive time, which again I think is kind of indicative of all the years from the 20s on of it all. I saw personally development in my area of the MBA and accounting programs. In addition, we've seen the growth of the petro engineering department, and a big spurt, of course, in the continuing in the international reputation for the research institutes up on the hill, as we call it, which is my area of interest today. The library facilities, I think, should definitely be mentioned, the one that we're in here now. The time I started back into school, it had moved out of, across the way, over into Fennell Building that time, without this structure being other than an architect's dream at that time. And my, how it's grown, and how fantastic it is today. The physical plant, of course, has added a multi-story building in the midst down here, not only on the hill now, with greening, the office and classrooms, the student facilities at Wood Center, I mean, a bowling alley, pinball machines, no less, the ice rink and the tennis courts, and the California transplanted housing up at Yakut State, all the many new fun things of the 70s. The all-new computer system, which introduced the bane of our existence, the financial accounting system at the university, that is still such fun today. But I've gone through this in, like I say, in the roles of a faculty wife, the student, and as a classified employee up to administrator. And my time in the university, I think, is just sums up the university as a whole. I was going to say during the periods of the 70s, but listening to everybody else from the 20s on, that it's been exciting, frustrating, demanding, but never boring. Thank you all.
I can go along with what Joan said there, the changing administration around here. At one point, well, part of my job still is getting people's signatures on various documents around here. But that, back in the middle 70s, I used to go down the hall in the Bunnell Building and check and see who was signing in the morning. After lunch, I'd go down the hall and see who was signing in the afternoon, because it may or may not be the same people. It was so bad that some people got scared and they didn't want to sign anything around here. But I think we've outgrown that. We have maybe a few other problems, different problems, but I think We'll get through them one way or another. We always have in the past. It's shown through over 60 years of the university that we have problems and we can work our way through them. I hope you've enjoyed this evening. I know it's been a lot of fun to me putting it together and now sitting here this evening and listening to it and seeing how well it comes out. I would like to thank Paul McCarthy for his kind use of his facility here, which is a very nice facility compared to the old upstairs of the gym that I used to sit in for a library. And I would like to have you enjoy the goodies out in the hallway there. Earlier this afternoon, Tanana Valley Community College presented the Chancellor's office with a huge, full-sized sheet cake. And it said, congratulations, 60th anniversary and everything. And apparently, I got up in the Chancellor's office just after the thing got there, or shortly thereafter, and the secretary said she didn't really know what they were going to do with it. And I said, well, that's no problem. Just tell Pat where he's supposed to be tonight and tell him to bring the cake with him. Well, he didn't make it, but I do have half of the cake back there, so we can enjoy that. Thank you all for coming, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.